You are listening to the podcast That's Life in Sweden, or as we say in Swedish, Sånt är livet i Sverige, with me, your host, Lisa Orsimäki. Today I want to welcome scientist and professor Anne Farewell to the program. How are you, Anne?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. And it's a lovely day out there.
It is. It is very nice today. Finally, spring is here in Sweden.
Exactly. To get to know a little bit about you, can you share a little bit about your background and especially how you became interested in molecular biology? And then what is molecular biology and microbiology?
So I grew up in the U.S. in a town called Buffalo near Niagara Falls. And when I was a kid, my mother wasn't a scientist, but she was very interested in science and the human body and such. And so I remember her telling me about cells and all these cool things that the body could do. And so when I eventually went to university, I studied biology and chemistry. And I got really interested in how we could really figure out how these little tiny things, I mean, these little molecules, we could understand how they moved around inside cells and changed major things about people and animals and everything. And so I got very interested in understanding that. And then eventually I focused my interest in microbiology, which is the study of microorganisms, in my case, bacteria. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I eventually got interested in it.
So can you just, what is the difference between molecular biology and microbiology?
Yeah, molecular biology deals with anything having to do with proteins, DNA, molecules.
Okay.
And microbiology specifically is bacteria and some other microorganisms like yeast. And so I study molecular biology in bacteria.
Okay.
But it is a fuzzy definition, kind of, because molecular biology is somewhat on the border between biology and chemistry.
Right. Now, you have an interest in DNA and genes that then led you to a PhD. What was the study about?
So my PhD was studying how bacteria adapt to temperature. So many bacteria can grow very, very well at a very wide range of temperature, even though they can't control their temperature. Whatever temperature it is, it's the temperature that they are. Mm. And so they can grow at 20 degrees and they can grow at 40 degrees. And I was interested in how the cell changed its gene expression to be able to do that.
Right. And for what purpose?
Purpose was not immediately obvious. I mean, it was a study that is basic science. As it turned out, it is of interest when it comes to expressing proteins. So a lot of proteins are expressed in bacteria and yeast for use in people. For example, insulin is produced in bacteria. And understanding how the cells respond to temperature taught us a lot about how the proteins are made and how they fold. And then we could make better systems for expressing these proteins. But that wasn't my aim from the beginning. That was basic science from the beginning.
Right. So what was your aim from the beginning?
It was simply to understand and learn, expand our knowledge about how genes are regulated and how cells can adapt to different temperatures. I didn't have any specific aim in the beginning, let's put it this way. I didn't have a practical aim in the beginning.
And it's not like the PhD where you have a research question and you see.
Well, the research question was how do bacteria adapt to temperature, basically.
All right. Okay.
That was the research question.
Wow. And we'll get a little bit more, we'll talk about that a little bit later. But so what brought you to Sweden?
Well, I did my PhD in Michigan, and when I was finished with my PhD, I didn't have a husband or children or anything. And so I thought, well, I can go anywhere now. And so I decided to do postdoctoral work in Europe. And I started, at that time, it was writing actual letters, not emails, and trying to find somewhere where I could go work for a few years. And I found a group in Sweden. So I came to Sala originally.
Okay. So, and how long were you, where were you in Sweden?
So I came to Sweden after my PhD in 1993. But then I've been in three different cities, moving around a bit. Between Uppsala, Lund, and Gothenburg.
Okay. So where were you first? You were at Lund first.
I was at Uppsala first.
Okay.
Uppsala, then Gothenburg, then Lund, and then Gothenburg again.
Wow.
And then I got a real job.
So, yeah, okay. So how long have you worked at the University of Gothenburg?
Well, as a teacher since 1993, since 1999.
Okay.
I got my first real position as a junior lecturer in Gothenburg, at Gothenburg University at the end of 1999 and started here and have been here ever since.
Right. Now, also in a relatively short time, you then received a couple of pedagogical prizes for your pedagogical skills. And in 2014, you were awarded the university's first Excellent Teacher Award. Can you talk about the early days of teaching? Did you complete a teaching degree before you came to Sweden?
No. So when I started here as a junior lecturer in 1999, I was given my first assignment to teach a course in microbiology. And I had zero education on teaching. I had taught a couple of classes in the last 10 years. I mean, I didn't teach during my PhD at all. I was 100% researcher and honestly did not know I had any interest in education in particular. I mean, it was just not something I did. So I was given this course and I was told we need to fix it because it's not going well. And I didn't really know what I was doing. But I, with time, started to learn. At first, I taught the way I was taught, which was purely lecture format.
Mm-hmm.
Simply give lectures and that's it. And I found that very frustrating and boring. I wasn't getting feedback from the students, didn't feel right at all. And through listening to other people, what other people were doing, and also reading and trying different things myself, I eventually started using a number of different techniques.
Mm.
And as a group, I just call them active learning. It can be, I don't try to specify my style or pedagogic style at all beyond saying active learning. In other words, getting the students to interact with the material and with me during classes. So having, sometimes it'll be a more flipped classroom, sometimes it'll be more problem solving, sometimes it will be presentations. Anything that I'm able to help the students progress and see their progression in class rather than simply giving them information in class.
Mm-hmm.
Especially nowadays, I mean, we have the internet, we have huge amounts of resources for information. And so the pure lecture format doesn't seem that necessary to me anymore. I use it still, but I use it when it's appropriate, not all the time.
You know, thinking about that you're teaching in microbiology, I was just thinking about it when I thought, how do you teach microbiology? First of all, you must have students who are really interested in the area. I mean,
Yes. Generally, I mean, I've taught at a lot of different levels. So in courses that are, so the microbiology course is a third year course. So those students mostly are pre-set on microbiology or something very close to it. I also teach at master's level, and then it's even more, they're more interested. But in the first year, for example, we have all biology students together. And these could be students who want to work on plants, who want to work on anything. It just, they may not have any particular interest even in molecular biology. They may be more interested in ecology, for example. And I've also taught a course that is open to anyone at the university. So as long as you can enter university, you can take this course.
Okay.
That course is on antibiotic resistance.
All right.
And that was a very unique problem for me, of how to interest people. First of all, to interest everyone. And that meant some of the people were in the fields of law or economics, and other people were biology students or doctors or nurses, and trying to make sure that everyone got interested, no one got bored, but at the same time making sure that you were teaching at a low enough level so everyone could follow along. It was probably one of the most interesting teaching experiences I've had to try to set that up. And it worked quite well. It's a very popular course, so it's been running for a few years now.
So what do you think are the challenges when you think about teaching, whether it's in the area of antibiotic resistance or whether it's microbiology? What would you say would be some of the challenges?
Well, I think in especially my higher level courses, we have a lot of students from other countries. So we have students from all over the world, especially Erasmus students, for example. And so they all came through different programs, and every program has its own speciality, kind of. They focus on this aspect or that aspect. And so the backgrounds of the students ends up very different. And in a master's level course, you need to very quickly get them speaking the same language, so to speak, and making sure everyone has the minimum requirements for the course. And that can be very tricky some years. Students who really have missed large parts. And so I have to tell them, okay, you can do this, you can do this course, but you need to work a little harder in the beginning. You need to read this book, or you need to watch those videos, or whatever it might be, in order to catch up. And I think it would be a million times easier if everyone were the same level, but it's also much more interesting to teach this way. Because sometimes students, they might have, for example, much better chemistry than most students, and they will see things differently than the others do. And so that can be valuable as well. So it's got pros and cons, but it does create problems sometimes.
I'm thinking of some of the challenges when people come from different cultures, and of course the teaching culture here in Sweden differs.
I have had students who said, oh, I've never learned like this. I never had a course like this. But at the same time, at least in natural science, there still are a number of courses that are taught the old-fashioned way with mostly lectures. And so even the Swedish students, I have to spend significant time in the beginning getting them used to the idea of why I'm teaching this way, what I expect of them, how they can pass the course, things like that. I have to be very careful about explaining that to them because otherwise it would be a very scary experience.
And you got to be very specific then.
Yes,
Yes,
yes.
exactly. And you're talking a little bit about the benefits of teaching diversity, diverse students. And what if you were to say a couple of things that you found definitely that you have taken away from teaching students who are diverse, even if they don't necessarily come with the sort of background that you would expect in your course?
Well, I mean, it's a big question, kind of. I mean, diversity is extremely important in research in general. I mean, there have been a number of studies who have looked at whether diverse research groups do more creative science, and they tend to think a little differently, or they tend to have more ideas coming into the mix. And so having, for example, women, having men, as well as people from different countries, different backgrounds, is really a benefit to research in general. And I think it's a benefit in the classroom as well. Although, of course, you do have to be careful with expectations and things like that, because not everyone has the same background, of course. But in general, it's a very positive thing. I don't see very many negatives except where expectations are very different from the people involved. In other words, if I have a student in my class or in my lab who expects something different from me, and that has to be clearly communicated. I think 90% of the problems we have could be dealt with by communicating better in general. And that's,
In your area, do you have you seen an increase of male students or female students, or is it about the same?
Well, it's so there are more, it depends exactly the field, because in natural science in general, it is still more male dominated in general, except for pure biology. So, ecology and topics like that tend to be more women. But what's interesting and frustrating is, though, even though the number of women have gone up and up and up, the number of senior women has not followed pace in the last, I don't know, 40 years. I remember talking when I was a PhD student about, oh, well, maybe now we have a lot of women in the PhD program. Maybe now there'll be, in a few years, there'll be women at the senior lecturer or professor stage. And that did not happen. Of course, it went up some, but it did not go up like it should have. If you just look at the numbers,
So why do you think that was, or that is?
I think it's complicated. So I can tell you about this organization I founded some years ago, called Gothenburg Women Scientists, and this was done out of frustration. I think it was the main thing. Some of the things that were happening in the world in general. I mean, Donald Trump got elected, other right-wing people got elected, and very anti-women sentiment in politics. And I started to look around at my own department and realize that there had not been a woman promoted to professor in 20 years or some number like approximately. And so And we had lots of women, but they were all stuck at the level of associate professor. No one ever got to professor. Right. And that's, something's wrong. And so we started this group mostly, initially it was, I don't know what our initial thought was, but whether it would be, but what it turned out to be was really important, two things. One was to get women to talk to each other, because the topic was not discussed much at all. It was ignored. Everyone assumed in Sweden, we have equality, everything is equal. So anything negative that's happening to you as a person must be because of you. Whereas when you start to talk to other women about these problems, and I don't mean only women, other minorities, et cetera, as well, you start to see patterns of treatment. And it was, I think it was extremely depressing in one sense to hear that, especially from younger women. But it was also really important to empower in the group to understand that it's not just them, so to speak. And then we started to push in at the Faculty of Natural Sciences at both at Gothenburg University, and there was a similar push started at Chalmers just before we had started this group, to start to highlight gender inequality in natural sciences. And it's been really productive, I think. It's not as productive as I want it to be ultimately, but there have been significant changes made over the last 5-6 years at the Faculty of Natural Sciences to try to address some of these issues. And one of the most important things is that now it's included in the discussion. When they're looking at promotions, for example, they look at, are we looking at men and women differently? That wasn't the actual question you asked me, though. I realize you asked me, why is it? It's complicated, I think, is the answer. I think part of the reason this difference persists has to do with tradition. It's a very macho, competitive environment in natural sciences, and that does not, so showing weakness or showing being tough is a good thing, to be tough in this environment. And women and some men don't do well in that environment. They need it, really, it really selects for a certain personality, which is a shame, because it doesn't mean they're the best at science. It just means they're the best competitors.
Yes, yes. I was just going to say, just to hear that word toughness, and you're a scientist, I'm not quite sure how the two hang together. I mean, tough.
It's hard to explain that. It's funny hearing that question, because to me it's obvious, but of course from the outside it may not seem that obvious. In natural science, we need to compete for financing.
Yes.
We need to compete for space. We need to compete for people, et cetera.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so the most successful people are going to be the ones that compete the best.
Mm-hmm.
And generally that adds a toughness factor onto it. We like to think it's only about intellect and ideas, but that's not true. I mean, everyone, we're people, and people do respond in a way to this sort of competitiveness.
So
it is unfortunate.
So there's a bit of mateship or the boys' club, and then we can look
very
at...
Very much.
Yes, yes, yes.
Very much.
Yes. Now, the organization, the goal is to identify and visualize structured gender inequalities in the scientific community and work towards correcting them. So what are some of the things that you have seen? Actually, you say, yeah, well, this was a win. This is, a couple of wins, or how could you sort of say, well, yes, there are things are changing, and these are just a couple of examples.
Right. I think the changes, unfortunately, are small, but they are positive because they haven't happened before. The gender equality question or issue has been integrated into all the committees at, or most of the committees in natural sciences now.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that, for example, work environment, that is included in the discussion about whether or not some aspect work environment might affect women differently than men. It's taken into consideration more in the promotions committee, for example, that because we know that there are lots of studies showing that the way someone writes a letter of recommendation, for example, or an evaluation will differ depending on whether it's a man or a woman. It's interpreted differently. So, for example, for men might have great collaborations, but women may rely on their collaborators too much.
Yeah.
Even though it's identical. And so you have those sorts of things, which the awareness of this difference is being spread quite a bit now in the last 5-6 years. And that's been fantastic to hear. And now people actually, it sounds ridiculous, but people actually think about it now, which they weren't doing. They did 20, 30 years ago, but they weren't 10 years ago.
I'm just curious to, when I hear that, you know, there are women who may not be pushing themselves forward into positions or promotional opportunities once they have a PhD, regardless what field they're in, I always think about motherhood. Motherhood, you become a mother. And in Sweden, it's very typical that you finish your PhD and then you decide to start a family. And then that takes you actually away from your from the environment and from, you know, being part of the university life.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, that of course plays a big role, that women after they have children may decide that they don't want to stay in this environment. But it's not so much, let me put it this way, it's not so much that they're unable to compete anymore, because they do lose some time, that's for sure. But that's not usually the problem. The problem is they don't want to be here. They don't want to be in this environment where they're fighting all the time. You know, people will go 15 years desperately trying to get jobs before they finally get a permanent position. And that kind of instability is not good for people with children, and especially women with children.
So where do they go if they don't come back to university?
It's a very interesting question. We've been asking for more follow-up on this. But my impression, based on limited knowledge, they go to the companies. So they go to, for example, AstraZeneca in Gothenburg is a major employer of molecular biologists. If you look at that, the people working there, it's by far women. It's much more women. And I interviewed some women who were working in companies and asked them, is it better for you to work there? And they pointed out the same thing about competitiveness, that in the university you always felt like you were fighting with even the people around you, whereas in the company you all had the same aim,
right?
And that just felt so much better to be working together rather than competing all the time. And so I asked the question of myself, of everyone, why it's not that women can't do this job. It's that the environment is so negative to them. They don't want it anymore. And that is such a loss, that we are losing, we're not getting the best of the best. And that's what we really want as scientists and as academics. We're not getting that. We're getting the people that can handle this organization. And that's a terrible loss. Another interesting thing in Sweden, there was a study recently at GU that looked at younger men in natural science who were doing their PhDs and asked them, do you want to stay in this academic environment? And more they're saying no. They don't, because they want to take care of their kids. They want to have a life.
Yes, of
They
course.
don't want, and something should change. We shouldn't be selecting people who, I don't know, who their main advantage is that they're willing to give up everything else. We should be getting the best and the brightest.
And we're not.
We're not.
Yeah,
We
we're.
can't. I mean, because we don't select for them, so to speak. We don't, we're not attracting them.
How would you encourage women to study science?
Well, I mean, I absolutely encourage any woman to study science. Absolutely. Whether I would recommend you stay as an academic is a different question. But
Right.
studying science is absolutely fascinating. And I mean, we are equally good at it as men are. And if you find it fun, it is always interesting. It always changes. So you always have some new question you can look at. So it's a fantastic career. The job market, depending on the exact field, will vary, but in general, there are jobs and such. So it's a very good choice if you are interested in science at all. Whether I would recommend to, let's say, if I had a daughter who wanted to go into academia, I don't know at this point. I used to say go for it, and I still probably say go for it, but be aware of what the negative sides of it are. And that's, I've had a fantastic career, so I feel very lucky to have. I don't want to make it sound like I hate my career. I love my career, and I love my job, but I do see these patterns of exclusion of people, women in particular, that is not right.
We're not as inclusive as we like to believe that
No,
we are.
not at all. Not at all. Unfortunately.
A question I have to ask you. Seeking the award for the excellent teacher. Can you explain why you went for it, considering you were already a professor?
No, I'm still not a professor. I'm an associate professor.
All right, sorry.
Yeah, but it's I'm actually applying now. Yeah, I already had a job. I was had permanent associate professor position. Well, because I so the Excellent Teacher Program initially was designed to acknowledge not only research success or excellence, but also teaching and pedagogic excellence. And I very much wanted to raise the profile of very good teachers at the university. And part of doing that was raising my own profile. I think having this kind of program, concept of this program was a very good one to not only because we often, if you look at least in natural sciences, what you see are who got the biggest grants, who got the, Nobel Prize, or not that, but got big prizes and things. But we also should be looking at the education because we're a university.
Absolutely.
It should be on par. It should be equal as far as acknowledging education. And so when this program was released, I mean, I looked at the criteria. I mean, I fit the criteria perfectly. So of course I applied and got it.
Of course you got it. And and you've been there so many years now at the university. So what do you think makes a good teacher from your perspective? We're talking about now academia.
Yeah. I think there's several things, but for one, I think your interest and motivation in doing it. Like I find it fascinating to understand how my students are thinking and learning. Like how do they learn things? How do I explain these things to them? How do they take in this knowledge and become better and more knowledgeable, basically, and more creative in science, etc. I find that process very fascinating. And so because of that, I pay attention to the students. I listen to them. I see what they're doing. I see when things are not working, and I try to find a way to make it better. And I think you have to, I mean, it sounds silly, but you have to care and you have to listen. And then I think you can teach in many, many different ways and still be a great teacher.
Yeah.
I advocate my way of teaching, but I don't say it's for everyone. But I think the most important is that you actually realize that let me put it this way. There's big advantages in being a teacher at the university. It's why I'm at the university. If I didn't want to do teaching, I would be in a company. And it's the fact that we have young people around us. We have young people in the lab. We have young people in courses. And they come up with different ideas and different points of view. It's really awesome. It's so interesting and so helpful. And on the same side, so therefore, I want to contribute to their progression. And see, I find it very extremely rewarding. And I think often we're very stressed about, having to do 50 other things. So I think many people at the university would be better teachers if they weren't quite so stressed about other aspects of their work. But the ones who are excellent, I think, really care about what they're doing and really think about what they're doing rather than do it as just something I have to do in order to keep my job.
So what are your thoughts about artificial intelligence like ChatGPT? And do you prefer online to face-to-face, or is it a mixture? I mean, what's your thought about AI?
All right. Well, for the online, I can say quickly, I do both. And I prefer in person simply because there's more interaction with the students. But it has huge advantages and for some situations, because now that we can use Zoom, if someone is sick or if someone, it's bad weather out, and we can, it has huge advantages to use as needed or for certain kinds of courses that are my antibiotic resistance courses online over the summer, and that I would get very few people showing up in the middle of the summer to take a course like that. As far as ChatGPT, I'm less hysterical than some people seem to be about it. I think there are advantages, disadvantages, as everything. I think we do need to train and to teach our students about it, though, because the danger is that they trust it too much. I go in and I have experimented with many of them, and I have a few questions I put in kind of to test the system to see what it gives me. And sometimes it's fantastic and sometimes it's not. But you need to be able to determine which is which. And so I tell my students, I have to accept that my students are likely to use it. But I tell them, Okay, you can use it, but you need to go and find references for everything you say. Make sure that it's telling you the right thing, because otherwise it doesn't work. Where we do have a real advantage, I think, that I found in the lab is many of us are using computer programming, and we're not really computer programmers, but we need to use these tools. And ChatGPT makes it much easier to learn programming languages because you can put your code in and say, what's wrong with this? And again, you need to understand what it's doing, but it can be a very helpful kind of proofreader of both language and programming.
Absolutely. Your research interest in recent years has related to antibiotic resistance. So, can you talk about what has been happening in the area, and can antibiotic resistance be prevented?
Antibiotic resistance can be slowed down. Let's put it that way. It cannot be prevented, I don't think. The antibiotic resistance is becoming an extremely serious problem. There's on the order of a million deaths per year in the world due to antibiotic resistance infections. And that number is increasing and increasing every year. By the year 2050, the estimates are that it will exceed cancer as a cause of death. It's a huge problem. And it was in large part ignored by many people until maybe 10 years ago or so, when more and more researchers like me started to read more about it and realize how bad the situation was. And so for that reason, I switched my research from, I found places where I could apply what I was doing already to the problem of antibiotic resistance and got myself educated about the problem. And I'm very interested in teaching about it and teaching better ways to deal with antibiotics and antibiotic resistance because the public has a lot to do with this as well. There are a few things, I mean, there are a lot of new ideas coming up, not just new antibiotics, but new approaches. One approach is to use viruses that infect bacteria. They don't infect people, they only infect bacteria. One idea is to use that. There are other more mechanical ways of killing bacteria that might be promising. So there are a lot of different ideas of how to slow down antibiotic resistance. On the other hand, you have a very basic question of hygiene. So we in Sweden and Europe have extremely good clean water and sewage systems, etc. But that's not true in large parts of the world. And there is where infectious disease really is, can run rampant. And so fixing those problems are, I mean, we know how to do that. And so that if there is a will, we could do that. And we, in my opinion, should, because antibiotic resistance genes evolve in situations where you have a lot of infections, but then they spread. They spread to tourists, they spread through travel, etc. So, through water, through birds, it's everywhere. So, if something is evolved somewhere in a remote part of the world, it will eventually end up in Europe. And it may take a few years, but it's coming. And so we need to deal on different levels. There's several different l approaches. You need to deal with worldwide hygiene problems, for example, but then you also have drug discovery because we do need new antibiotics when the old ones stop working. And we need to not waste the antibiotics we have. So we shouldn't be giving them to animals. We don't in Sweden anymore, but I mean animals by livestock. But we have to consider them a precious resource that we really have to save for when they're really, really needed. And so there's lots of initiatives. I'm involved with the Center for Antibiotic Resistance Research in Gothenburg. And there are many initiatives both in education and drug development, as well as environmental issues, et cetera, that people are working on this. And so I think much of the microbiology world has started focusing on antibiotic resistance and, of course, pandemics
I was
for
just going to ask.
obvious reasons.
Oh my goodness. You know, that was actually a question. I thought, okay, now this is leading closer to maybe another pandemic. What's happening if we what do we need to do? I mean, the environment, there is no doubt we have to do something about climate change and environment. And I don't know how interested our politicians or, you know, stakeholders are really. But because what you're actually saying is scary, because I did have a look at that and I thought antibiotic resistant, it sounds like we are moving to another naughty, horrible pandemic kind of situation.
Yeah, it will be different. I mean, the pandemic was so terrible because it was we hadn't been exposed to this virus before, and it has spread throughout the world very quickly. Whereas resist infection, bacterial infections, we get them commonly. I mean, often our body fights them off. But if you think about something like urinary tract infections, incredibly common amongst women. And what you do there, you generally take antibiotics. But if the antibiotics don't work, then most people, most women will, or men and women, but mostly women, will eventually fight off the infection. They'll be sick longer and more sick. And but then some will die. I mean, some will get kidney problems and will be very sick. So it won't be the same as the pandemic where it just kind of swept across the world. This will be a slower thing where what they refer to is we will go back to a pre-antibiotic era. So before 1940s, we didn't have antibiotics, and so things like surgery becomes much more dangerous, and cancer treatments become more dangerous because of the chance of infection. So it will not be. The pandemic was like a big explosion, whereas antibiotic resistance is more creeping up on
Slow.
us. Yeah, it's a slow process. But
Mm-hmm.
people are working. I mean, the good news. So I give a lot of talks about antibiotic resistance, and what I usually say, I mean, this is all the bad news. I have lots of bad news. But the good
Yes,
news
give
is,
us some good news.
yes, people are actually working on it and paying attention to it more and more and more. And so you should be supporting politicians and such that mention it and that are
Who?
interested in this problem.
Who is mentioning it?
Yeah, I don't know. That might If you find one, you should support them. But there are initiatives in Sweden, and for example, the Research Council of Sweden is very involved in supporting research in antibiotic resistance. And WHO has programs on it, the UN has programs on it. And so people are becoming aware. And so that is the hope. And we do have a lot of tools now
Okay.
that we didn't have 100 years ago. So I'm not completely hopeless about the situation. I get a little frustrated because it goes slowly, but I think we will find not one solution, many solutions.
Okay, that's good. What's so your next, it's continuing in this research and finding alternative ways of how we treat ourselves with antibiotics.
So what I'm primarily working on now is there are Bacteria can exchange genes between themselves. So it'd be, for example, if I met you in person and I handed you my genes and you would get my genes. That doesn't happen, but it does happen with bacteria. If they meet, they can transfer genes. And often these genes are antibiotic resistance genes. And that's how the antibiotic resistance genes are able to spread so quickly throughout the world and throughout people, et cetera. So what we're looking at is trying to find a way to slow that down or prevent it, and so that you won't be able to transfer the genes. It won't solve the problem, but it'll decrease the problem.
Are you studying certain type of genes, or is it any genes?
Any genes that are on these, we call them plasmids, these small pieces of DNA transfer. So we're interested in stopping those plasmids from going between cells. And if we can do that, then it will slow it down. That's the overall aim of the research. Find ways, and then maybe finding places where it would be most useful to slow that down. For example, in wastewater treatment plants, we think might be a place that a lot of this transfer is happening. Or when a person gets an antibiotic, maybe you will take this so that you don't pick up a resistance gene. One thing that I want to mention is really the value of education in not only at the university, but of course at the university, but also amongst everyone and the general public. We have a situation in the world where we're overflowing with information, but it's very hard to understand what we're seeing. In other words, we don't know what's real, what's not real, what's serious, what's not serious. I'm talking about antibiotic resistance being a problem, but you can read about many other crises as well. And so I think educating the general public about science and science thinking is hugely important so that people can really determine for themselves how important an issue is to them. I think the purpose of the university, and this is because I come from a more maybe utopian but liberal arts kind of view of university, that university is for education. And on the side of that, integrating education into research and into society is equally important. The fact that I can bring young students into my lab and show them how research is done is a fantastic thing, both for them, society, and for me. It benefits everyone, in my view, to be able to have a university that is both pushing research, but equally pushing education and spreading education as much as possible. And I think we have a fantastic opportunity now to be able to spread education more easily. We have the internet, we have YouTube, we have podcasts. We can do all these things. And I think we should be encouraged to do that more and more and become more integral into society.
Wonderful. Thank you and so much for your time.
You're most welcome.
And I'm sure we will catch up again in the future.
Yes. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. And you have been listening to the podcast Sånt är livet i Sverige, or in English, That's Life Here in Sweden, with me, Lisa Orsimäki. Till next time, take care of yourself and each other. Bye for now.